This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Online bezahlen? Mit Apple Pay ist das ganz einfach. Wenn du auf den Apple Pay-Button tippst, kannst du deine Karten und Versanddetails direkt überprüfen. Du willst was ändern? Einfach antippen, um deine Angaben zu aktualisieren. Dann nur noch deinen Kauf mit Face ID autorisieren und in Sekunden abschließen. Mit Apple Pay wird Online-Shopping noch einfacher.
Jetzt gibt's Cheez-It, ein neuer knuspriger Snack, der köstlich nach Käse schmeckt. Hol dir jetzt deine Packung im Handel und das Beste, du kannst sie einmal gratis testen. Wer will heute Abend den Cheez-It? Cheez-It, der Cheez-It. Jetzt zum Gratis-Testen. Teilnahme ab 18 Jahren. Kauf- und Kassenbon-Upload bis 30. Juni erforderlich. Nur solange der Vorrat reicht. Teilnahmebedingungen auf Aktionspackungen und auf cheez-it-aktion.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. There's been an ominous build-up of tension between the United States and Iran in recent days. Its most obvious manifestation, the deployment of a US aircraft carrier and its strike group to the Gulf. So this week, I'm looking to be briefed on how close the United States and Iran may be to going to war. And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Last week, for example, we looked at whether measles vaccinations should be made compulsory. On Monday, the Foreign Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, said he was worried about a conflict breaking out between the US and Iran by accident. On Tuesday, the US military raised its threat level in the Middle East in response to intelligence about Iranian-backed forces in the region. On Wednesday, non-essential American staff at the embassy in Baghdad and elsewhere in Iraq were told to evacuate. And this all came after the US hastened the deployment of an aircraft carrier strike group to the Persian Gulf. So today I want to know, what's going on? Are the United States and Iran in danger of going to war? Step inside the briefing room to find out. The origin of this latest ratcheting up of tensions was the American decision in May 2018 to pull out of the Iran deal, the JCPOA. I'll say that again, the JCPOA, the agreement signed by six countries and Iran while President Obama was in office. It was designed to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. Ali Vaez, who is the director of the Iran project at the International Crisis Group, came into the briefing room to tell me about it. The story begins in 2002.
The Iranian nuclear crisis started with a revelation by an Iranian dissident group that Iran had nuclear facilities that it had not declared to the UN nuclear inspectors. The International Atomic Energy Agency was absolutely unaware of a clandestine enrichment facility and a heavy water reactor that Iran was building. The reaction was shock throughout the world, and I think the Europeans were afraid that Iran would be the next target of the Bush administration's hawkish policies. So they took the initiative of trying to contain this crisis. The three European countries, France, Britain, and Germany, started negotiations in Tehran in 2003. When the negotiations with the Europeans came to naught, the advocates of engagement with the West were discredited in Iran, and the more hardline factions of Iranian politics gained the upper hand. The period between 2005, when Iran resumed its nuclear activities, and 2013, when an interim agreement was reached between Iran and the world powers, was marked by what I call the race of sanctions against centrifuges, meaning that the West, Europe, and the U.S. continuously imposed new sanctions on Iran and gradually increased the economic pressure on the Iranian economy in the hope that Iran would come back to the negotiating table and agree to limit its nuclear activities and subject them to very rigorous monitoring by the UN inspectors. But in parallel, Iran also tried to strengthen its hand by continuously installing new centrifuges for enriching uranium and expanding its nuclear activities in a way that by 2013, Iran was only 2 months away from the ability to accumulate enough enriched uranium for a single nuclear weapon. What changed in 2012 was the fact that both sides' leverage had plateaued. But the key ingredient was the opening that President Obama offered to the Iranians in secret negotiations in Oman, in which for the first time he stepped aside from the maximalist demand of zero enrichment in Iran and accepted that the Iranians would have the right to a limited enrichment program on their soil. An interim agreement was put in place that basically froze Iran's nuclear program in return for some limited sanctions relief, but opened the way for negotiations about a longer-term comprehensive agreement. A nuclear deal was reached in July of 2015. The deal really boils down to a simple trade-off, in which Iran agreed to roll back its nuclear program and put them under time-bound limitations to rebuild trust in the civilian nature of its nuclear program and subject them to the most comprehensive and rigorous inspection mechanism ever implemented anywhere in the world in return for economic incentives and normalization of its trade ties with the outside world. The reality is the deal didn't do much to change Iran's policy with regards to its ballistic missiles or its support for partners and proxies in the region or its human rights record. But by the time that the deal was implemented in January of 2016, unfortunately, it didn't really have too much time to prove itself because in November of that year, President Trump was elected on the promise of tearing it apart.
As I have said many times, the Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into.
President Trump started basically undermining the agreement initially by refusing to certify that Iran was complying by its obligations under the deal, and then by withdrawing the U.S. from the agreement in May of 2018 and reimposing sanctions that were lifted under the agreement. When it withdrew from the deal in May of 2018, it basically turned it into a dysfunctional deal because economic incentives that were promised as part of the JCPOA never materialized or could materialize without the United States, given the U.S.'s dominance in the global financial system and the reach of its sanctions regime. And the U.S., through flexing its financial muscle, has been able to scare away most of the foreign companies and multinational companies who had an interest in investing in Iran or doing trade with Iran, and has also successfully managed through its unilateral sanctions to cut Iran's oil exports to almost a quarter of where they were about a year ago. And through that, the U.S. has been able to inflict massive harm on the Iranian economy.
Ali Vaiz on the nuclear deal. But if the deal has been the proximate reason for a deterioration in relationships, it's also just part of a wider problem between Iran and the West, and particularly Iran and the United States. So what I want to know now is who is shaping policy on either side of this widening divide? Because in both countries, it's more complicated than you might think. To tell us about the US dimension, we have Cori Sharkey in the briefing room. She's the Deputy Director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies here in London. Cori Sharkey, when it comes to Iran policy, who in Washington is actually calling the shots?
Always a good question in the Trump administration. But I think 2.5 years in, it seems pretty clear that the president himself is. The problem is that the president's ultimate decisions, which I think are fundamentally not to elect to go to war against Iran or North Korea or any of the other things that his administration is threatening. The problem is that the whole rest of the administration is sending contrary signals to the president. The National Security Advisor, John Bolton, is talking very tough. He wanted to be the person who made the statement saying that an American aircraft carrier was being diverted to counter Iranian escalation. Secretary Pompeo, I think, trims his sails to whatever the president says or tells him to say. So I think he's a much less consistent signal than Secretary Bolton. And the acting Secretary of Defense, Patrick Shanahan, is trying not to say anything that will cost him congressional confirmation votes.
Let's talk a bit more about John Bolton's agenda, because he's a character with history.
He's a sharp-edged hawk on Iran and on North Korea. But actually, I think the North Korea negotiations provide a good window of expectation about how the Trump administration may behave on Iran. Namely, you saw a lot of tough talk by the president early on. You saw the National Security Advisor suggest a preventative war. And then the president exchanging love letters with the North Korean leadership. So the whiplash that the National Security Advisor has to be getting as a result of, it looks to me, being told by the president to take a very hard line and then being undercut by the president, whose reflexes are to try and deter action by others, but not if it's actually going to require the United States to carry out those threats.
Does somebody like John Bolton actually believe that the U.S. should try and effect regime change in Iran?
That is what he has said clearly and consistently over long periods of time.
President Trump has very much set his face against regime change because of the commitments it involves.
The problem is that the president's not behaving consistently. He behaves erratically on a wide range of issues. But also the reason that John Bolton is bad at his job, because saying we need to reinforce deterrence by taking all of these really sharp-edged measures when you can't deliver the president on the policy ultimately is a terrible way to do your job as National Security Advisor.
Whoever is having an influence on President Trump, as of this moment, do you think you can detect what his objective is with regard to his policy towards Iran?
Yes, I do think I can discern his objective, which is to coerce or intimidate the government of Iran into agreeing to give up its nuclear weapons program, to permit inspections of its nuclear infrastructure, to bring it back into compliance with UN resolutions constraining its ballistic missile program, to prevent it from threatening free passage of shipping in the Straits of Hormuz, to prevent it from undercutting the governments of Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and others, and to roll back its influence in the region. I can tell by the expression on your face, already understand that the Trump administration has a very low probability of achieving that outsized list of objectives. But two things. First, the Trump administration is not putting anywhere near the resources it would take to achieve that objective. And among those resources should be gaining the support of America's allies, which their policy has ensured we will not have. But the second reason it's not going to be effective is I'm not the only person who can see that President Trump is unwilling to pull the trigger on a major war in the Middle East. All of the signals he is sending on Syria, on Afghanistan, on Iraq, are that the United States wants to write off the Middle East.
Corey Sharkey. That's Washington. What about Tehran? Who runs the show there? A question for Anise Barisi Tabrizi. She's a research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, specialising in Iranian affairs. Dr. Tabrizi, when it comes to nuclear policy and military policy, who actually makes the decisions in Tehran?
Well, the Iranian decision-making system is quite complicated. The main assumption is that the supreme leader is the ultimate decision-maker and is the one calling the shot on all the security and international affairs. The nuclear issue, when the situation became an international crisis, the whole dossier was transferred to the so-called Supreme National Security Council. This up until 2013, when the whole dossier was transferred under the control of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs when Rouhani was elected. That was one of the requests of the Rouhani administration. So since then, the main control has actually been from the Rouhani administration and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. However, since the dossier is considered quite important, all the different bodies are also involved in it.
So on nuclear policy, it's mainly President Rouhani, but other people have a significant input.
Precisely.
Let's broaden out from nuclear policy to look at the other things which seem to concern the American administration a great deal, which is Iranian security policy in the region and its support for various actors in neighbouring countries and other countries. Who's in charge of that?
I cannot really say that there is one single actor. However, if we have to pinpoint who is the main decision maker or implementer of that policy, we can say that these are the Revolutionary Guards, specifically with regard to Syria, to Iraq, to Yemen, and ballistic missiles. One interesting aspect of this all is that part of the reason why the Rouhani administration wanted the nuclear deal to succeed was to take over more control on some of these issues. So we have seen, for instance, right after the nuclear deal was announced, the attempt of the administration to take over control on Syria through the negotiation, through the talks, that has not succeeded. Part of it is because, of course, of the limits of the presidency, but the main part of it is actually because of the failure of the nuclear deal to stand alone as a success and therefore allow the administration to require a say on other issues as well. There is a division within Iran and the Iranian system. Clearly, you see Rouhani and his administration talking about engagement and improving relationship with all the countries in the region still to this day. And then you hear the Revolutionary Guards talking about escalation, talking about resistance, talking about using every tool available to respond to the threat and to the enemies, both from the region and outside the region. So the dialogues are very different and the rhetoric are very different and the policies are very different. But in the end, whatever is the outcome of the Iranian policy, it's something that has been decided collectively.
Dr. Tabrizi, what I'm getting from this is that we have President Rouhani who wants to moderate the course of action and the Revolutionary Guard who don't want to have it moderated. Is that broadly right? And if that's the case, who's winning?
So I think that was broadly the case, mainly the case until a year ago. There was a significant division between the two sides. You can see, for instance, when ballistic tests were conducted, Rouhani was criticizing it. However, over the past year, since the relationship between the US and Iran has worsened significantly, there has been actually much more unity between the two sides. Not only ballistic missile tests, for instance, have been defended, but also when the US designated the Revolutionary Guards as a terrorist organization. We have seen all the figures from the administration and parliament dressing up as Revolutionary Guards in sign of support for them. And that has been, I think, a symbolism that demonstrates much more cohesion between the two sides because they feel like they are threatened and that the Revolutionary Guards effectively defend Iran from outside threat through their non-conventional tools.
Anise Barisi Tabrizi. So, what are the chances of a conflict, accidental or deliberate? Barbara Leaf was the director of the Office of Iranian Affairs in the US State Department during George W. Bush's second term. She then became the US ambassador to the United Arab Emirates. And she's joined by Robert Cooper, a senior diplomat who, among other things, represented the EU in the Iran denuclearization talks. Barbara Leaf, we seem to be looking at a very quickly evolving situation. As you've watched this unfolding in the last few weeks, has your own thinking about what might happen evolved at all?
Well, David, it has. So I would go back to May 5th, May 6th timeframe when John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, made this announcement of an accelerated deployment of the carrier strike group. And then there were follow-on announcements of other pieces of systems that were deployed towards the Gulf, linking all of that to any attack on U.S. interests or those of our allies being met by unrelenting force and citing pieces of intelligence. Now, these, to my mind, are kind of conventional approaches that administrations have taken with Iran over the years. My thinking was altered somewhat on Tuesday evening when I learned that the Department of State was going to order a substantial evacuation of U.S. personnel from the embassy in Baghdad and the consulate general in Erbil. That is a very potent signal.
We should just say that Erbil is the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan.
Exactly. That is a very potent signal. It's a signal either of the U.S. reckoning that threat is increasing, that the government of Iraq is unable or unwilling to contend with that threat against U.S. personnel, and others can read it as a signal of U.S. intent. That very much confuses things. And confusion is the last thing you want in a steady state of tensions between Washington and Tehran, and it is the last thing you want when there are actually significantly heightened tensions between Washington and Tehran.
So, Robert Kubio, originally, quite a lot of these sort of talks seem to fall into a category of things that we've seen and heard before and conventional responses, but that this more recent move seems to depend on genuine intelligence, including from allies, that something troubling might happen.
There are two things that worry me. First, the US has already done a lot of damage to Iran. Economically, the Iranian economy is really in bad shape. Inflation's running at 50%. The EU hasn't been able to do anything about that. So what's the next step for the USA is what that makes you think. And I also, hearing that State Department people are being moved out of Iraq, that really is a worrying signal. When you talk about intelligence, that always worries me. Because I remember somebody showing me pictures of what looked like mobile dustbins and explaining that these were mobile biological weapons that were going to be used by Saddam Hussein. And I think that I believe them. Maybe I'm more worried than I should be, but none of that sounds very good to me.
Let's imagine for a moment, long stretch I know, that I'm the British Foreign Secretary, and I'm seeking your advice about how things might possibly escalate and whether or not, at the end of such an escalation, there's a possibility of something accidental happening rather than as a deliberate policy. What would you tell me, Barbara Leaf?
So look, in a state of heightened tensions, such as exists now, and where there is decidedly more room to go in this escalation and in this ratcheting up of tensions, there is certainly ample room for accidental conflict, no question. And it's made all the more realistic a scenario by what has consistently been a paucity of channels of communication between Washington and Tehran, well, for 40 years, but we have had more direct contacts and communication with Tehran in recent years under the previous administration than currently exists now. What does exist is, of course, the Swiss channel. I would draw your attention to the White House announcement yesterday previewing a meeting today between President Trump and the president of the Swiss Confederation, in which they will meet to discuss matters such as Switzerland's role in facilitating diplomatic relations. Now, that's a very clear reference to what we call the Swiss Channel. The Swiss have covered our interests in Tehran for decades now. And when we want to pass a direct message to the regime in Tehran, we often use that channel. There are other channels, and one of them was used last week by Secretary Mike Pompeo when he went to Baghdad, abruptly changing plans to go to Germany, went to Baghdad personally to convey in detail to the prime minister and the president of Iraq U.S. concerns about threat streams, intelligence that we have collected indicating plans, moves by Iraqi militias to attack U.S. facilities, U.S. personnel in Iraq.
Now, I suppose in what you're saying, one of the scenarios that could happen is that an Iraqi militia undertakes such an attack and that attack is
Absolutely.
Interpreted as an Iranian attack. Is that the kind of way in which an escalation might happen?
I think the Iraqi government is under no illusions whatsoever that we will take with the utmost seriousness an attack by Iraqi militias, which are seen to be proxies of Iran. the Iraqi government has been messaging those militias for the last several days. So that's all to the good. But the U.S. may not necessarily respond in Iraq, and indeed it would be quite complex to respond in Iraq. It would most likely have very dire implications for our relations with the government of Iraq. So we might respond elsewhere.
Robert, you had an awful lot to do, both with the European Union and its relationships with Iran, trying to form a series of contacts. Has Europe, firstly, had a role in acting as an interlocutor between Iran and America, which is lessened now? And second, because of your contacts with Iran, what do you think their response would be to an escalation in any kind of military terms of a crisis? What do you think they want out of it?
I think the important thing to understand is that none of us really understand how the Iranian government works. Every now and then, when I was dealing with it, I started thinking to myself, well, I think the Iranians are doing this because of that. And then I slapped myself on the wrist and said, no, actually, we haven't got a clue how this government works. I guess the Iranian government is in a constant state of negotiating with itself every day. It's a phenomenon that's not unknown in this country. And you never know what's going to come out of that. And I guess that there may be people who would even welcome a little bit of heightened tension with the USA. And they may see that as a good way to move Rouhani aside, for example.
David, I think Robert's made an excellent point here. And this is from a seasoned diplomat from a country that has had a more or less a steady state diplomatic presence on the ground in Iran for decades. When I was referring to the paucity of communication links, I would also say that that goes to the issue of Washington's own understanding of its adversary. Against a backdrop such as we have today, it is all the more difficult to suss out. My concerns go back to the issue of deterrence. And deterrence, to be effective, really requires very robust and synchronized public messaging with allies, so that allies and we are not on wholly different pages as we seem to be.
Well, and not just with allies.
Exactly.
Deterrence requires, above all, communication with the adversary.
And that has been, I'm afraid, all over the map this past 10 days.
But even just to go back to what I was saying before, even when you're talking to the Iranian government, you don't know whether you're really talking to them or
yes.
not. You don't know who you're talking
so,
to.
So, Barbara Leaf, what's your impression of how the different views within the administration would be likely to play out? I mean, President Trump sets it out very clearly. You put your cases to me, I decide. But the question, I suppose, partially is what those cases are and on the basis on which of his instincts he would follow in order to make that decision.
I wouldn't even call it an instinct. I would term this a conviction, a deep-going conviction that against further U.S. engagement in wars in foreign fields, and a side-by-side conviction that he has the capability to break through conventional diplomacy, conventional military standoffs, etc., and strike a deal. Side-by-side with a very harsh line towards the regime in Tehran, he's been signaling himself all the way through his avid desire to meet with the Iranians and to negotiate a better deal than the Iran nuclear accord of 2015. Now, you could say that then Bolton plays bad cop to his good cop. Ultimately, the president is going to decide. Every president does do so. I think this bears little resemblance to the conditions we saw in 2002-2003. There is risk of misapprehension and accidental conflict. What Iran does in this setting counts for a lot.
And Robert Cooper, you're nodding.
Yes, I'm nodding because I worry about Iran doing something stupid.
Robert Cooper there and Barbara Leaf. And if I can try and sum all that up, we don't expect a conventional war because no one wants one, but this is a combustible region and accidents and miscalculations can happen. Thank you to Ali Vyas, Corey Sharkey, Anissa Barisi-Tabrizi, Robert Cooper and Barbara Leaf. We'll be back next week. Until then, goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Tim Mansell, Kirsty Knight and Serena Tarling. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds.